Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. When it comes to an important financial contract, here's a phrase you don't want to hear.
It's just got holes all over the place.
That's consumer advocate Amy Bach with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Amy says a certain contract is more like Swiss cheese than a binding document. In her words,
it's just got holes all over the place.
So here's a quiz. What contract is Amy talking about? Is it A, a standard homeowner's insurance policy? They don't cover everything you think they do. Or are we talking about B, cell phone contracts? Some providers charge you roaming fees in your own neighborhood. Or is the problem document C, a credit card contract? All that fine print conceals potential pitfalls for borrowers. No clue? No worries. We've got the answer on Marketplace Money, up next from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Earthquake, flood, fire, pestilence. You don't know when disaster is going to strike, so how do you know what to do with your insurance? I'm Tess Viglund, and we are staying upbeat on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Here in California, we've had a sneak peek at what's in store for the summer, and it ain't pretty. Fires in the Hollywood Hills, fires on Santa Catalina Island. They're out now, but Florida and New Jersey took their turns battling blazes this week. And, of course, hurricane season is coming, all of which got us thinking about homeowners insurance. How much coverage do you need? What should you cover? We asked Elisa Roth to find out.
Jeremy Zeiler's earliest memory of growing up in Colorado is the day the dryer caught fire. He says he and his mother looked up to see flames coming down the hallway.
The last minute, we both, took off out the door and went to the neighbor's house. And I remember sitting there, staring out the window, watching the house burn down.
So you might expect the Brooklyn-based web designer and artist to be fanatical about protecting his belongings. But he thought he couldn't afford renter's insurance. Recently, though, there were a bunch of break-ins in his neighborhood, and he's convinced that now's the time to do it. How do you go about comparison shopping insurance? The Insurance Information Institute's Jean Salvatore says there are three questions to ask any broker or insurance company.
Do I have enough insurance to rebuild my home?
That, of course, only applies to homeowners, not renters.
Do you have enough to replace all of your belongings? Do you have enough liability protection to protect your assets in the event that you're sued?
The number one mistake people make when buying insurance is to not get enough. In a survey last year, Salvatore's Institute found that more than half of American homes were about 20% underinsured. There are a lot of reasons for that, from not knowing how much your stuff is worth to forgetting to change coverage after big home improvements. So how do you know what to insure? Salvatore says the best thing to do is to inventory everything in your home. You can go high-tech, use a video camera, or go low-tech and make a pencil and paper list. Zeiler took the middle road using a digital camera when I visited him on a rainy evening this week.
I don't know about clothes. How do you go back and document clothes?
When you're doing an inventory, you don't need to count up how many socks you have in your sock drawer, but you want to make a notation that maybe you've got what you've got. So you want to say, I've got three good suits for work, and I've got this sweatsuit for the gym, and I've got sneakers, and you want to add up all of those items.
If you have high-value items, a fancy stereo or collectibles, you want to let your insurer know. You probably need an appraisal, too. And of course, don't forget to store a copy of the list somewhere else, at a friend's house, in a safety deposit box, or even online. Take a look at your insurance policy, and you'll see that it covers a long list of what's known in the industry as perils. That's disasters to you and me. Fire, theft, tornadoes, wind, earthquake, and flood insurance have to be bought separately. Amy Bach directs United Policyholders, a nonprofit consumer organization. She says even with that extra coverage, people should triple check what's covered.
In this day and age, your homeowner's policy is more like Swiss cheese than a blanket. And it's just got holes all over the place.
As many homeowners learned after Katrina, it can be hard to tell what caused the damage. Say whether it was rain coming in from above or floodwaters rising from below that ruined your living room carpet. In any case, she says, make sure you go with a reputable insurance company. Most states have websites that list insurers licensed to cover your area. Get the highest deductible you can afford and don't make superfluous claims. If you can afford to fix or replace something out of pocket, do it. As for Jeremy Zeiler, the agent he spoke to said it would cost $600 a year to insure all of his stuff. He's still hoping to find a policy for about half that. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Think you know how much to have on hand for retirement and when to start using that money? Well, your friendly neighborhood radio host thought so, too. Until I read a recent article in the New York Times. It featured an economist who says we're all thinking about this the wrong way. Lawrence Kotlikoff teaches economics at Boston University, and he says don't start drawing on Social Security benefits the second you're eligible, which, of course, is exactly the opposite of all those online retirement calculators.
Well, if you go to, for example, Fidelity's My Plan, which is their new calculator. It has five questions. You just can't even begin to get any, give somebody decent advice based on five questions. It's like going to a doctor and getting a one-minute checkup. It's really a form of malpractice. And they're using the conventional replacement rate methodology, which was developed by the insurance industry to sell more product.
What is the replacement rate methodology? What are you talking about?
Well, the replacement rate methodology is asking how much income do you need after retirement to replace the income you had before retirement.
That's where we always hear about the you need, 80% of your income while you were working or something like that.
Exactly. Okay. The typical advice is that you should target to have income of 80% of your pre-retirement income, 80%. And that's far too high for almost all American households. And then the next thing that happens when people are given a target that's way out of bounds, I refer to this as like pimping risk. They get people set up with a target that's far too high, and then they induce them to invest in things that are far too risky.
So how does this fit into your argument that you should really delay taking money out of everything from your, you know, the money that you've socked away individually to the Social Security benefits that you could potentially start getting at 62?
Yeah, you can start taking Social Security at 62, but if you wait, Social Security gives you a much higher benefit, about a 75% higher benefit if you take it at 70. And it turns out, for very good economic reasons, that it makes much more sense for most people to use their regular assets and their 401k money, their retirement account money, to tide themselves over and wait as long as possible to take Social Security because the increase in the benefit is so generous that Social Security is offering you.
Can you give us an example of the math on that? Say you're making $50,000. And you want to retire at 62, what would be the benefit to you of waiting until you're 70 to start withdrawing Social Security?
Well, again, if you can use your regular assets and your retirement accounts to tide you over to maintain your spending before age 70 and then move on to your Social Security benefits, well, I've done cases for people at around 60. They can typically raise their living standard by about 10, 12%.
So by waiting until 70, your annual payments from Social Security are much greater.
Yeah, they're going to be about 75% higher. That's a huge increase.
What about those like me who are in their 30s and don't believe that Social Security will still be there when we retire?
Well, there's reason to be concerned. The system is about 20% underfunded. We need radical reforms of Social Security, the healthcare system, and the tax system to really find our way forward into the future. If you guys could just elect me president for the day, I'll take care of the whole thing.
I'll see what we can do about that.
Okay.
Lawrence Kotlikoff is an economics professor at Boston University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I paid $3.53 a gallon for gas this week, but that was a pittance compared to what I would have paid if I went to Bob Oyster's gas station in San Francisco. Try $4.33 a gallon. The Shell station owner told the San Francisco Chronicle he was out to make a point, not a profit. He says Shell overcharged him for gas and hiked his rent. Clearly, there's more to the price at the pump than the cost of crude. For a breakdown, we've turned to Severin Bornstein of the University of California's Energy Institute. So does Mr. Oyster have a legitimate beef here?
Occasionally, the service station operators try to make this into a big oil versus the small businessman deal. And in some sense, it's right in that big oil is always trying to squeeze the service station operators. But they then try to extend it to say, this is why gas prices are high. And it's just not.
It certainly seems like whenever we hear about the price of oil going up, you know, you hear a spike of a dollar or even $2, and automatically the price of gasoline goes up at the corner station, despite the fact that I believe oil prices are determined 3 months in advance of when they actually hit the market. Is that correct?
Well, oil prices that get reported are generally prices for delivery a couple months from now.
Yeah.
But oil is a storable good. So when the price goes up for delivery a couple months from now, it's generally pulling up the price for delivery even tomorrow.
Well, this entire discussion that we've been having is predicated on the notion that gas prices follow oil prices. But really, recently, oil prices have not been rising. They've stayed fairly flat, and yet we've seen this huge jump in the price of gasoline at the pump. What's going on?
Oil prices are the first component. The next component is the refinery margins, and that's what's gone through the roof over the last few months. The refineries are still able to buy oil at around $60 a barrel, but now they're able to sell gasoline for 50 or 75 or even as much as 90 cents more than they were during last fall.
Yeah.
So what we've seen is the profits of those refineries has gone through the roof. We haven't built any new refineries in the United States since the 1970s. And as a result, if you do own a refinery, you're able to make a lot of money running it.
How likely is it that we're going to see any relief anytime soon? I mean, I know that the travel season always brings higher gas prices through the summer, but are we ever going to get back to the point where we're seeing $2.50, $2 a gallon?
We have always seen somewhat higher prices during the driving season, but up until a few years ago, the differential was just a few cents a gallon. But as we go through the summer, I would be surprised if we see much relief in the price of gasoline.
And there are certainly those who argue that we shouldn't see any relief in the price of gasoline, and that the higher it goes, maybe the more our collective consciousness will force us to buy smaller cars and not drive as much.
But there's an important difference between high prices that are going to refinery profits and high prices that are going to higher government taxes. If we did this through raising gas taxes, we could use the revenue to lower other taxes, such as our payroll and income taxes.
All right. Severin Bornstein, thanks so much for helping us figure out this riddle of gas prices.
Glad to be with you.
A house overseas is now yours. Chris maps out an inheritance plan in the mailbag. And you think your life is a roller coaster? For this guy, the roller coaster is his life.
Because we spend a year, year and a half maybe on the coaster. It's a lot of time to think about it and wonder what it's going to be like.
It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Weglund. How do you celebrate the start of summer? Trip to the beach, a new set of shades. How about a day at the amusement park? Hundreds of them opened this month. And aside from funnel cake, the main thing they have in common is the rumble of roller coasters. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we buckle in and chat with the guy who designs them.
My name is Chad Miller. The name of the company is the Gravity Group, LLC, and we are wooden roller coaster designers and engineers. I've known that I've wanted to do this since I was like 9. I didn't have a wide variety of riding experience anyway as a kid. I do now because we go to a lot of parks and, you know, we ride as many coasters as we can while we're there. But I went to Cedar Point and Kings Island just about every summer as a kid. I would spend the two-hour drive home sitting in the back seat drawing roller coasters. Coaster enthusiasts have very strong opinions about which is better, steel or wood. Of course, I like wood coasters better. There's been kind of a rise in the demand among small parks. They're seeing other small parks have success with them. You know, and it's a small park can afford a wood coaster because they're cheaper. For a medium-sized wood coaster, 3,000 feet long, you might be looking at anywhere from $3 million to $4.5 million or $5 million. Depends on who's building it. Depends on how many trains there are. Depends on the topography of the land. If it's a nice flat site with really good soil, then it's a lot cheaper than if it's a real undulating site and maybe not so good soil. There are not a lot of people doing what we do, but with the two or three other people that are doing it, it's very competitive because we can make a living on one or two jobs a year. But if we don't get that one job, there's no half a job, it's all or nothing. I don't make any more than a normal engineer makes with my experience level, and I might even make less. You know, we have a good year, we make more. I would say between 50 and 100,000 is the range that it might fluctuate between. The ride we're doing in Texas now is called the Boardwalk Bullet. It's a very small site. The actual footprint of the coaster is 1 acre, but it's pretty 200 foot long wooden roller coaster. So it's wound tight in there. It crosses over itself 42 times or something, which is insane. We look forward to riding our rides at the end of every project. That's really the reward because we spend a year, year and a half maybe on a coaster. It's a lot of time to think about it and wonder what it's going to be like. And plus seeing other people ride it and listening to their reactions as they get off of the ride, looking at their faces, and that's a really rewarding day. I don't really like heights, and sometimes I'll walk to the top after the ride's done or while it's being constructed. I make myself do it. I don't really like it, but I don't mind being in a coaster car up that high. It's when I'm walking or, I have to count on my own dexterity not to trip over something, then I'm worried. If I'm strapped into something, I don't care.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Katie Orr.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Hook, Line, and Sinker brings us this week's Marketplace Money Buzzword. Bait and switch. Bait and switch is a fishy sales tactic. The seller lures you in with the promise of a product perk or feature that seems like quite a catch. Then, when it's time to close the deal, the terms, conditions, or product suddenly change. This week, New York's Attorney General Andrew Cuomo accused computer giant Dell of bait and switch advertising. He says Dell reeled in customers by dangling pledges of 0% financing, then raised the rates upon purchase. Dell denies the charges. Now it's up to their lawyers to get them off the hook. Got a box full of letters.
Think you might like to read. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's that time in the show where we listen to you. And here with me is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, and I think we're both ready for another round of questions from listeners.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, before we start answering the questions, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org, and you can click on the contact button there, or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And, Chris, we're going to reach into the email bag, first of all, here, and I have got a doozy for you. I don't know if you're going to have an answer to this, but Jesse writes in from Novato, California, and he listens to the show and wonders why we don't have pictures of Rico Galliano and Chris Farrell on our website. He went to the cast section and they're missing.
Well, why?
I think it's a question for our webmasters, actually. No, but you know what, Chris? I have the answer to this question.
I know you like me. I know you like me. I'm not taking it personally.
No, I'm not taking it personally. Actually, no. You can find Chris on our Marketplace Money website. Again, it's marketplace.org. Click on the headline there that says Marketplace Money, and you'll see a photo of Chris right next to his blog, which is a new feature on our website. And you can go and not only look at Chris's wonderful countenance, but you can get terrific advice and some thought-provoking notions of what's going on in finance. And if you'd like to see Rico, you can go to our website and click on the Educating Rico segments, and we've got a photo of him right there. So there you go. Hope that helps, Jesse, and happy hunting. And our first caller is Henry, and he's with us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Hi, Henry.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. How's the weather there in San Juan?
Oh,
need I ask?
It's another beautiful sunny day.
Oh, can we come and visit?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Please come down.
Okay, we'll be there next week.
You're welcome.
How long have you been there?
Actually, I've been here for about a year now, but before that, I actually commuted back and forth from New York.
What were you doing in New York?
I worked for a Fortune 500 company as a director of operations and technology in a learning department, online learning.
So how did you end up in Puerto Rico if you were working in New York?
I fell in love.
With the island?
Well, that too, but with somebody.
Okay.
Yeah.
A double whammy then. So what are you doing now to make a living?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've started a consulting company, a project management company, and that's really part of the question that I have is I did what I shouldn't have done. I took a major risk. I cashed in my 401k.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Yeah. But because I felt, look, I'm fairly young. I want to give starting up my own business a chance. And that's what I used to, finance the business.
Henry, you mentioned you're young enough that you're not terribly worried about having taken out your 401k money. How old are you, may I ask?
I'm actually 39.
So you've still got a good 20, 25, 30 years to rebuild your retirement fund. So what's your question for Chris?
So the question for Chris is, I think I owe on my 401k. My taxes. So I filed an extension, and now I'm not quite sure what the situation is with regards to possibly owing on the 401k, but the funds having been used to finance the business really hasn't shown any profit. So what can I do?
Not much at this point. However, what I would do, first of all, it's been done. You're going to owe ordinary income taxes plus the 10% penalty on the 401k. But my main piece of advice would be hire a professional. There may be some things that you can do just to lower your overall tax bite. If you don't have much income, then the income tax rate that you're going to be paying on the money that you took out, that's not going to be much. So, you know, maybe you took it out at an opportune time.
Chris, is there any benefit or drawback to the fact that he is in Puerto Rico? Are they under the same tax system?
There's a broad misconception, Tess, that if you live in Puerto Rico, you don't pay federal taxes. Many people don't pay federal income taxes, but there are all kinds of federal taxes that they pay, you know, import-export taxes. You still have to pay Social Security tax. And then there are the local taxes that you're going to have to pay. So actually, the tax bite can be even higher in Puerto Rico than it is here off the island.
Chris, about hiring a professional, I'm not sure if I should hire a New York professional or a Puerto Rican professional.
When I lived in New York, the person that did my taxes was from Puerto Rico, and he had actually a large clientele that went back and forth between New York and Puerto Rico, as you were doing for a long period of time. So actually, at this point, depending on who you hire, I think that you'd come out ahead either way. Because you live in Puerto Rico now and because you have a small business, I think you would want, and you've moved from New York to Puerto Rico, I think you'd want to develop a relationship down there.
And certainly the number one qualification would be that they're willing to do your taxes on the beach.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, good luck finding that person.
Well, thank you very much for your advice. Really appreciate that.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's check our email bag, and we've got Ellen writing in from Rochester, New York. And she and her husband are both full-time graduate students. They contributed to their Roth IRAs this year, but they're frustrated because they weren't able to get the Savers tax credit when they filed their income taxes this year. Do you know why students are not eligible for this credit?
Who knows what goes on in the mind of the tax writers? I mean, here one of my favorite examples is if you're married but file singly, can't do a Roth. Can't do a Roth conversion.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the logic behind that? Oh, wait a minute. I'm asking for logic from Congress?
Exactly. I have two theories. I have two notions of what's going on. One is that trying to limit the cost of the Savers tax credit, and the assumption is that students aren't exactly saving a lot of money. They're spending what they do in a very different investment, which is investment in their education. And the other thing is that students are also eligible for a number of other credits that have to do with their education. And so it may have been felt, you know, look, there aren't going to be that many students that are going to be able to save. There aren't going to be that many students that are going to take advantage of the credit. And they already have things like, you know, lifetime learning credit and that type of thing that they can take advantage of. But that's my own theory. And if someone has a better theory, I'd love to hear it.
And if anyone has a theory on why Congress enacts things like this that really don't help people much at all, we'd love to hear that theory as well.
That's going to be one full email box.
Well, that's what we like. All right. Well, if you've got a question about personal finance, come to us. We're kind of like a dollar doctor. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. Let's hit the phones again. We've got Sam on the line from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
How are things in Denver?
Oh, very good. Very good.
Excellent. How long have you lived there?
I've lived here around 7 years now.
Okay. What do you do?
I'm a computer engineer.
So you're one of the folks who writes all that complicated code that none of the rest of us can decipher.
I guess you could say that, yes.
Well, thank you for doing that on behalf of all of us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So what's your question for Chris today?
My question for Chris is in regards to foreign property. My wife's family has a property that my in-laws use occasionally when they go back over there to India. And they've wanted to pass it on to her, and we wanted to see what the tax consequences were. And I have two particular questions. The first one is essentially tax consequence, both positive or negative, of foreign property ownership if we were to pay the property tax and all that stuff. And the second part of my question is the tax consequence if we were to convert that into a rental property for part of the year.
Wow, lots of questions. Chris, I think we've dealt with this on properties, say, in the Caribbean, but I don't think we've had a question for as far away as India. Do the same rules apply?
Well, what has happened with India is they've liberalized a lot. And so there's a lot of money that's pouring in from the Indian diaspora. It does turn out, and this is the good news, is that the U.S. and India have a tax treaty. And so once you have a tax treaty and rental income actually comes under the tax treaty, then that really does cut down on, you know, double corporate taxation, a lot of those issues. So quite a few people in the Indian community are doing exactly what you want to do. So you could actually just get some informal conversations. But this is an area of international tax law. And therefore, you're going to need to work with someone who has experience in international tax law, because I don't know if you ever looked at one of these treaties. Yeah, you need a little bit of tax background to understand exactly what's going on here.
So is there any way to tell them whether there's any tax advantage to having a rental property in India?
Oh, there is tax advantage. So 30% tax advantage within India itself to having a rental property. So there is absolutely tax advantages within India itself toward having a rental property. So I think it's a great idea.
Well, there you go, Sam.
Great.
Rent away.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Sam. Need a place to stay for vacation? Well, we can't help you with that, but we can help you save enough money to take a vacation. Give us a call and we'll try to help. It's 877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Or just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, how about one more reach into the email bag? And Bill has written in from Rochester, Minnesota, and his three-month-old daughter passed away not too long ago due to sudden infant death syndrome. Of course, our condolences go out to Bill. He had purchased a life insurance policy both for his daughter and for his three-year-old son, hoping that that would help with future insurability. Now, unfortunately, he stands to collect on his daughter's policy. In some ways, of course, he doesn't even want the money, but he knows that he should use it for his son. So here is Bill's question. How can he create a retirement plan for his son, something that he can't use on a whim as he ages, can't touch perhaps until he's much older and near retirement? Bill doesn't want to use it for a college plan, so this is really using the insurance money for a retirement plan for his son. What's the best setup here?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I just would like to say, Bill, that the best investment that anyone can make is in a college education. So I would at least urge a second thought about putting the money toward a college plan, just because over a lifetime, that is the biggest return on an investment. If you really don't want to do that, then what I would do is put the money aside in treasury bills, you know, blue chip, money market mutual fund. And as your son gets older and starts earning some income, then you could start funding a Roth IRA. That's probably the other way that I would approach it. And with a Roth IRA, when you withdraw that money in retirement, it's tax-free. And so if you can imagine, I don't know when your son's going to start earning some money, but your son will still be very young. So if it's compounding over a 50, 60-year period of time, that's a long time. That's a lot of compounding, and there's a lot of wealth there. That's an alternative. If I was trying to think about setting the money up in a retirement, that's what I would do.
But your initial kind of gut reaction is to go ahead and start setting up a college fund, like what, a 529?
A 529 plan is probably the best idea. That's what I would do, and I really feel terrible. But you could get more complicated depending on the money with trusts, but let's just keep life simple. 529 plan, perhaps a Roth.
All right. Well, again, our condolences and best of luck to you and your family, Bill. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit the contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, as always, thanks so much for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
Up, down, up, down. The stock market's been topsy-turvy lately, but our investment club in Virginia is riding high.
All our stocks right now are in the plus column. We have no minuses. We really need to pat ourselves on the back because it's not been an easy market.
And the market for weddings has exploded. It's all about love, honor, cherish, and debt. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Back now to our investment club series. We're following three clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
We're back with Formerly Baroque. They're 12 women of a certain age who gather once a month for a coffee klatch where the talk is of stocks, bonds, limit orders, and grandkids. Our last visit was lovely, but kind of boring. Not because of them, they're great, but because all of their money was fully invested in the market and they didn't want to make any moves. By our next visit in April, things had changed. This time, instead of meeting at somebody's house, the club met in a room on the second floor of an enormous grocery store called Wegmans. They started with a prayer, acknowledging a national tragedy in their state that week, the shootings at Virginia Tech. Then Marjorie Wieda called the meeting to order.
Do we have a quorum? We have everyone here.
Okay, financial report, Pat.
We've recovered nicely from the Shanghai dip. At the end of March, the whole portfolio dipped to $88,000. As of last night, it's $96,000.
And I think it was 96 last time I visited you in, what, early February?
Right. The dip affected us greatly. I said it was up 6%. It's up 9% since that dip. And our stocks have recovered nicely. Some of them we sold.
What did you sell?
We sold Homex and Healy's.
You sold Healy's?
Sadly.
So you're back up at about $96,000 invested. So you haven't hit the champagne mark yet.
Correct. It is on ice.
But a couple of weeks later, on May 11th, they finally did pop the corks as their investments soared over the $100,000 mark. Well done, ladies. But amid the good news, some club members were frustrated that some of the stocks they'd sold, the Mexican builder Homex and the wheeled kids' shoes called Healy's, went up after the club dumped the stock.
What that suggests is that we need to keep, all of us, is to look at these stocks that we've sold, not just Homex, but other ones, and let's just look at what's happening and then to rebuy.
They all agreed to that. And from there, it was time to check in on their portfolio.
We'll begin reviewing our stocks now, and our Irish Bank, Allied Irish Bank, thankfully came back up. And it just came back up even in the last week. I have mixed feelings about this when I look at the other ones and what some of the other ones have done. I still like the idea of this diversity and investing in foreign bank. So I'm going to courageously suggest that we sell if we need the money. Pat?
This is Franklin Resources. Has done very well. I'm going to ping the analysts again. Citigroup downgraded it yesterday, day before yesterday, and it went up $1.32 yesterday. So the stock itself is up 11% since February. It was 117.29 at that meeting. It closed yesterday at 130.29. I recommend a hold, possibly a buy.
And those rubber shoes they love so much, the Crocs, still turning a profit, according to club member Fran Betzner. But others had some concerns.
Crocs is holding its own. It closed yesterday at 53.68 and has been pretty much climbing a little and dropping back and climbing a little bit, but I think we should just hold.
If I could make a comment on Crocs. 2 weeks ago, my Land's End catalog came in, and I got, ooh, look, Crocs on the back. It's not Crocs. It's Trello. So you're having a lot of knockoffs, and the way I feel about it, if people buy the knockoffs, if they're not as comfortable, they'll just say, well, that's it. They're not going to buy Crocs because they're going to think it's the same.
So if you have concerns about knockoffs, why hold on to the stock?
Because it's still going up.
Well, and one other caution also in our portfolio, it's our major investment, $21,000, because we have 400 shares of that.
In the end, they voted to hold on to all those shares. But they did sell a wee bit of the Irish Bank. And with that money and some other cash in their account, they brought on board a couple of new stocks. One is Sun Hydraulics, which makes hydraulics. The other, a company called Case New Holland, which makes big tractors and other equipment. Maureen Anderson pitched that stock to the group.
Okay, this one is CNH. I'll read the summary first. The corn industry is nearing historic levels. CNH sees a bigger piece of its business from the ethanol corn gold rush. Earnings weren't too good before 2003. 2003, they started coming back up, advancing through the last two quarters to 129% growth. It is $40.25 per share. This is a good time to buy.
In all, they okayed the purchase of 550 more shares of six different companies. No doubt, some of those decisions launched them over the $100,000 mark.
All right. Any other old business? New business?
Okay, that's a wrap.
And that's a wrap for the latest round of visits with our three investment clubs. If you want more information on how to start your own club, we've got a link to the organization Better Investing at our website, marketplace.org. You can find the entire series there as well, plus photos of the clubs and all the fun they're having.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Here comes the bride, all dressed in white lace and silk chiffon with a 10-foot train, a veil secured with hundreds of tiny pearls. On the altar, towering white calla lilies wrapped in pink organza ribbon. A chauffeur awaits outside to whisk bride and groom off to a party with 200 guests and an open bar, and everyone takes home a brick of pure platinum. Okay, maybe not in that last part. But the typical American wedding still costs a fortune. Rebecca Mead's written all about it in her new book, One Perfect Day.
They say that the average American wedding costs $28,000. The industry is worth $161 billion. So it's an awful lot of money is being spent on the pursuit of perfection. I'm not sure whether it's being spent on the achievement of it, but that's the expenditure.
How did we get to this point where we expect perfection out of this day?
It's a very emotional sale, isn't it? I mean, the people in the wedding business know that this is one occasion in people's lives when they'll be willing to spend top dollar. Somebody said to me that, you know, there are three events, birth, marriage, and death, when somebody will spend top dollar and not look for a discount, and I make as much money as I can on those occasions. People aren't looking for a bargain on their wedding day. They're looking to make it very, very special. And they, you know, the wedding industry exploits this fact to the max.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about Kleinfeld's in New York, the very, very famous wedding gown store, and their motto is that the day that you find your wedding dress should be just as wonderful and exciting as your wedding day. And I have to tell you, the day I tried on my wedding dress was horrible, because if you're not a two or a four, trying to figure out actually what that sample is going to look like on you. I mean, it's just a lot of this stuff, it's hard to make it fun.
Well, one of the things that I learned while I was reporting One Perfect Day was something called the Oh Mommy moment, which is the moment in the bridal store when the bride tries on the gown and sees herself fulfilling the fantasy that she's been having. And she turns to her mother who's with her and she says, "Oh, mommy." That's the emotional high pitch. And that's also the point at which the salesperson will say to her, you know, you need a veil with that. You need a tiara. You need a pair of shoes. This is where they come in and really make the sales pitch.
And at some point during that process, you have to look at the price tag.
Right. That's another Oh, mommy moment indeed. But, you know, they'll always show you the more expensive dresses so that you'll perhaps fall for the more expensive one first.
It really is a mass manipulation of your emotions and your finances, for sure. The industry really has this down to a science.
They do. I mean, I went to seminars, I went to classes where people are taught how to be a wedding professional. You know, if you're going to be a wedding planner, do you have the bride to your house where you can create a sort of persuasively bridal atmosphere, or do you go to her house so that you can perhaps size up how much money she's going to spend on the wedding before you've even walked in the door by looking at the value of the house and the cost of her car? It's increasingly a professionalized business.
How many brides do you think look back on what they spent on their weddings and think, oh my goodness, it is such an enormous layout for such a short amount of time?
I think that the fact that it's going to cost so much money is so often repeated. I mean, everybody knows that weddings are extravagant and elaborate. And so, you know, as soon as you get engaged, you start being told that the average wedding costs $28,000. If you spend $15,000, you think you've got a bargain. And the things that one buys for a wedding are very often the prices that are higher if they're wedding related. I was at a bridal fair not long ago, and I was talking to a limousine company. If you rent the limousine for four hour slot, it's, you know, $650 or something. If you rent it for a wedding, it's $750. And you can't rent it as a 4 hour non-wedding slot. If it is a wedding, they won't let you in the car if you're in the gown.
So given this average of $28,000, what do you get for that? What does a standard wedding look like?
I was told by the Association of Bridal Consultants that a standard American wedding now requires the services of 43 different professionals. So there's an awful lot of different people who are getting in on the act. But I think that people will be surprised to learn that many of the things that we think of as elements of a standard wedding, you know, weren't standard at all not so long ago. I found a study from the 1930s in which a middle-class American group were surveyed, and one-third didn't have an engagement ring, one-third didn't have a wedding reception in addition to the ceremony, and one-third didn't have a honeymoon.
What do you think our wedding style as a nation says about us as consumers?
What it says is that we have turned this event into a consumer event and a consumer experience. And certainly becoming engaged transforms you into a new kind of consumer.
May I ask, are you married?
I am married.
What was your wedding like?
It was very modest. We were married on a Thursday afternoon by a judge, and then we had a party in the house that we already lived. It was much, much less expensive than the average American wedding.
Rebecca Mead is the author of One Perfect Day. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you know, you can always elope. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, the federal government's data meisters came out with their latest measure of inflation this week, the Consumer Price Index. And for April, prices at the checkout counter rose 0.4%. But as always, when this number comes out, we hear this caveat. Care to say it for me?
Absolutely. Take out food and energy, and you get the core rate of inflation.
Ah, drives me nuts. All the headlines this week were like, hey, gas and food prices are up, but hey, take them out, and inflation's a tame 0.2%. But, Chris, I still pay for food and energy. And, in fact, I saw that the government is predicting we're going to see the fastest jump in grocery prices in the last 15 years. So why do economists insist on pretending it's not a factor in inflation?
Look, I understand the frustration test. Just as you mentioned, you know, food's expensive. It's getting more expensive. And, you know, gasoline prices, they're set to break the record that was reached back in 1981.
Ouch.
But energy prices, food prices are volatile, very volatile. So here's the straight story. The real question is, are rising food and fuel prices triggering a broad jump in the cost of living? And the answer is no.
All right. Well, let's talk about this whole issue of volatility, because
Okay. Really,
gas and food prices have been rising pretty steadily the last several months. How does that not a trend make?
You know, yes, gasoline's more expensive. We all know that. How long have we been talking about this?
A long time.
I mean, it's been quite a while now, you know. And yet, when you look at the price of clothing, the price of toothpaste, you sort of take this whole economy, this rising price of gasoline and food has not spilled over into the rest of the economy. Look, when you listen to the radio and it has a lot of static, you want to filter out that static. We get all these signals, inflation signals, but there's a lot of static. And what we're really trying to do is put on these filters. And that's what the core rate of inflation is. It's just a filter, a quick snapshot. And any snapshot has its flaws, but it is an attempt to look at what's happening beneath the surface.
I guess I kind of get that, but I still don't understand that if food and fuel prices are rising, doesn't that by definition mean that our cost of living is rising.
The jargon term is relative prices. In an economy like ours, you know, prices are always changing. I live in a high inflation economy. And the reason is I have a wonderful child that's in college. The relative price of sending a child to college, and I have another one coming along, and it's going to be even higher when he goes to college. But that doesn't mean the overall rate of inflation is rising.
So why don't we just take out food and energy from this whole equation then?
I wish we could, but here's the reason why. What's the question that we're trying to answer? Food's up. Energy's up. Is it spilling over to the rest of the economy? And so we include it overall. We try and look at the underlying trend, but here's also what we do. We don't just look at the consumer price index. I mean, that's the index we know. But there recently came out, import prices are down. Personal consumption expenditure price index. This is the one Alan Greenspan loved. It's a broader measure of inflation. It's down. And the overall trend, guess what? Ben Bernanke's not a bad economist. Basically, he's been forecasting that we're going to have moderate economic growth and moderate inflation, and that seems to be the economy we're getting.
Let me ask you one more question. This has been a great education, but I still want to know how high prices for food and energy don't trickle in to the rest of the economy.
Look, what companies would love to do is raise their prices. The price of energy, it's very, very important in the making anything. They have higher energy prices.
Right, right.
The problem is the consumer is not doing well on the wage front. So sure, companies can go ahead and try and pass on the costs. Guess what the consumer's going to do? They're going to go to a product or a store that will not raise their price. So companies cannot pass on the higher costs of energy these days.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, I think you've made it so that the next time the CPI comes out, I won't tear my hair out.
That's progress.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, look, touch, but don't feel like you have to buy.
Some are just totally dreaming and need entertainment for free, so they go to open houses. And sometimes they get free chocolates, like we're giving away today.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes, with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.